I want to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Elizabeth Mburu, who is, she has a lot of accolades, I could tell you. She created Langham, and she created Actia, and she works for those two organizations, and she's also on the Board of Governors for Kenya Baptist Theological College. She's a good friend. She was trained in the U.S. at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and she is definitely going to be the, never mind, I won't say that. Yeah, it would be something good, but maybe not appropriate, so I'm going to let you come. Let's give Liz a big hand, will we?
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate the good words. I thought you were going to say something else, so I'm glad you didn't. All right, so we are continuing with our conversation together. I hope you can all hear me. And I hope I can see my screen as we start. I'm not going to wait for people to come in. I'm just going to go ahead and get us started because of time. When Kevin asked me to do this topic, I asked him, what does that mean? And he said, I'm sure you'll figure it out. So this is me trying to figure out what Kevin had in mind when he asked me to do this, regaining the African theological voice. And since I'm in biblical studies, I wanted us to look at the biblical text a little bit as well and let that ground the discussion as we go forward. So I'm going to give you some lessons from the Gospel of Mark. And it's just because I've been working on Mark, and so it's familiar to me. So as we begin this discussion together, because at the end of it, I hope that we will have a time of interaction, just like we did with the previous papers, I want us to just think about some things. And I want us to really consider that some may question what value Africa has in contributing to theological discourse. We were just talking back there with some of my colleagues, and when lecturers or faculty or whoever the librarian goes to buy books, you have a Western book, a book by a Western author, a book by an African author, the book by the Western author seems more valuable. So that's what they go for. So some may question what value Africa has. Some might even pay lip service to the idea of Africa's contributions, but not be serious about it. And I hope that there are none of us like that in this group. Because we might just be saying we need Africans to write, we need African contribution, but then when it comes right down to it, we don't really embrace it. And so we need to think about that. Some Africans might not even believe that they have anything of value to offer. And this is true. There's some Africans who say, you know, in a group like this, what can I say that would be useful, especially when you think about the kind of scholarship that has come from the West? So the premise behind this paper is that the African voice is a vital contribution to the global theological conversation. Unless we Africans stand up to be counted, and unless the global church embraces African theological contributions, it will never fully realize its potential. And I think we need to think about that. Right now, the church, as it currently stands, is like a half-finished song, in my perspective. While it's beautiful to listen to, it has an unfinished quality that leaves one yearning for more. And I think we all know what that feels like. So from the African position, this song needs to be finished. And I think from the Western position, you also need to recognize there is something unfinished about the church until we come in. So there are some significant contributions from Africa in church history that I want us to take a look at. Simply because the topic is regaining the African theological voice. And so to regain something is to suggest that one had something, perhaps lost it, or it was taken away and is now attempting to recover it. And I think that at the grassroots level, right now, many Africans have long believed that Christianity came to us in the 19th century with the missionaries, But as most of us now know, and I think everybody in this room knows that, this is patently false. Christianity did not come with the missionaries in the 19th century. Christianity was nurtured in Africa almost from the moment of its inception, and I think the previous speaker alluded to that. And so this paper will mention a few significant figures just as a way of grounding the discussion, not because I think you don't know this. I know you do. I'm not a church historian, so a lot of the church history details don't really interest me, which is unfortunate, but that's the reality. My husband is a church historian, so I'm always asking him, is this accurate? Is this the way things went? But I think, as an African, the past sheds light on our present, and it gives us direction for our future. And actually, in some cases, the past might even be more important than the future. And so it's important to think about that. So biblical records show evidence of Africans who doubtless influenced the shape of Christianity. I forgot my timer. In some way. The Gospels and Acts, of course, have several references to individuals from Cyrene, which is modern Libya. Mark, in relating the events surrounding the crucifixion of Jesus, records that a certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. We also see that reference in Luke and in Matthew. Luke, in Acts, notes that as a consequence of the persecution of the early church, some Syrian believers moved to Antioch and began preaching the gospel to the Greeks who lived there. That's in Acts 11. He also records that shortly after Jesus ascended into heaven, and this is the one we always cite as Africans, Philip was on the road from Jerusalem to Gaza when he encountered an Ethiopian eunuch. Of course, there's a lot of debate surrounding who this Ethiopian eunuch was, who the queen was, and all that. But let's just say he was an African, and she was queen of the Ethiopians. We claim that. So he shared the gospel with him, and having heard the gospel, of course, he returned home to share it with his fellow Africans, presumably, right? That's in Acts 8. So that's the biblical period. When you think about the patristic period, we see several prominent African theologians that contributed to debates that shaped Christianity. And I'll just mention a few of them and their theological contribution, because it's important for this particular discussion that we have today. So as early as the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries, Tertullian added to the growing list of doctrinal contributions. So we know that Tertullian is viewed as the father of Latin theology. And if I say anything that is factually wrong, just talk to me after. Just kind of side chat me. Don't like bring it up in the, you know. So he is viewed as the father of Latin theology because of his influence on the Western church. He not only coined the term Trinity to explain the relationship between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but also defended the unity of the Old Testament and the New Testament against Marcion. And he was a strong proponent of the sufficiency of Scripture. So this was an African that did this. And up to today, the doctrine of the Trinity continues to guide us. Origen, who was born in Alexandria, Egypt, contributed to hermeneutics, although that was the allegorical interpretation, but all the same, he made a valuable contribution to hermeneutics. And while his contributions to Christology and universal restoration were problematic, nevertheless, his contribution to the development of Eastern Christian thought is undisputed. He did a lot of other things that contributed to the theological discussion. Yet another African, Athanasius, helped clarify the concept of the incarnation as it relates to the divinity of Christ. He played a major role in countering Arianism. I think we've all studied that. Some of us teach that. That's a heresy which plagued the church in the 4th century. And this heresy was effectively countered during the Council of Nicaea. And it was the first ever ecumenical council that affirmed that Jesus was of the same substance as the Father and eternally God. Do we still believe this? Amen. Athanasius, an African, he developed all this kind of thinking. Both the Nicene Creed and the Athanasian Creed helped to cement the church's understanding of the nature of God. They continue to guide the church even today. So do Africans have something of value to contribute? I would say yes. History has shown that. And to this list, of course, who do we add? Augustine. You can't forget that. The bishop of the city of Hippo in northern Africa, who's long been regarded by church historians as the most influential Christian thinker in church history. He contributed to the development of various doctrines, including the church and sacraments, grace, and the Trinity. And his works, in particular, on the city of God, which I actually have not read in totality, managed to achieve a synthesis of Christian thought. And Martin Luther depended on his theology as he developed his own theology. I could go on, but I think the point has been made. This brief excursion into early church history is evidence that these early African believers not only shared the gospel, because we know that they did during the biblical period, but they also shaped Christian theology and succeeded in countering numerous heresies. They were at the forefront of the theological conversation. I think you would agree with me. They were right at the forefront. So clearly, their contributions had a tremendous impact on the direction the church has taken. I think you can almost say Africans shaped the direction of the church. And I believe we will, again, the question is how? How are we going to do that? In what direction are we going to take it? So Christianity cannot therefore rightly be called, and no offense to anybody, the white man's religion. We can't call it that, even though so many people now are rebelling against Christianity because they say it is the white man's religion. These are things that we need to be teaching our students. They need to understand their roots. So when we fast forward to the present situation, we have a very different scenario. There's been an unprecedented numerical growth, and there is much that is good in African Christianity. I don't want to demonize all African Christianity. There are some good things out there. There are also some bad things, just like in the West. So there's much that is good, but the contribution of the African church now cannot measure up to what it was. So what happened in that intervening period between the patristic period and today that eroded the contribution of African Christians? I'll do just a very brief kind of summary of that brief period up until today, and just say that doctrinal controversies, importation of Greek philosophy into Christian thinking, erosion of biblical theology in the perspectives of many church fathers stunted the growth of the church. Of course, all that can be debated and can be argued, and we can talk more about that. The arrival of Islam, I think, in the 7th century changed many things. That might have been one of the ones that changed many things. And also because the church was a Latin church and it was not indigenized, the common people in North Africa were unable to relate to it. We're still making the same mistakes today, actually, if you think about it. By the time the Muslims and the Vandals invaded North Africa, the church was already severely diminished. I see some people nodding, so I am right on track with church history. So when Arabs invaded and occupied North Africa, they were able to effectively terminate the expansion and growth of Christianity. And so that happened in that intervening period. Of course, we still see the ancient Coptic and Ethiopian Orthodox churches. Those survived. They are still very vibrant. They are still very dominant in these communities. So during the Middle Ages and the Reformation, there was no significant Christian activity in Africa, although there were three Nubian kingdoms that were in existence at that time, Nubatia, Makuria, and Alodia, and those survived until the 14th and the 16th centuries. However, when you come to the 15th century, then you begin to see Christianity being reintroduced. It was being reintroduced to West Africa by Roman Catholic priests that accompanied Portuguese excursions. By the 18th and 19th centuries, there had been attempts made to Christianize the whole of Africa by various organizations, some of whom are still represented to the present day. That officially marked the onset of the missionary era. So Africa now has the largest number of Christians in the world. I think that happened last year. It happened last year. That growth accelerated after the end of colonialism and of mainline missions. Isn't that interesting? That after colonialism and mainline missions, that's when the African church exploded. And we can see that this is some kind of crusade. I think it was Reinhard Bonnke. And you can see thousands upon thousands of people gathered just to hear the gospel being preached. So the unprecedented growth of the church in Africa has caught many by surprise. There's a gentleman named J.R. Mott. I got this from Lamin Sane's book, Whose Religion is Christianity. And Mott told the attendees to expect Africa, that was in 1910, in a conference held at Edinburgh, expect Africa to be taken over by Islam. Because by that time, Muslims outnumbered Christians 4-1. There's a conference I'm attending this week as well, and there's a gentleman, I forget his name, but he is predicting again that in the next 100 years, Islam will be the official religion of Africa. So I don't know about that. But those are the same kinds of predictions that come, and then Africans take everybody by surprise. And so Sane suggested that national awakening took place after the colonial period. So colonialism might have been an obstacle. So that's why there was this rapid expansion. There was also a cultural renewal that came hand in hand with Bible translation. When you put a Bible in the hands of a person in their own language, something happens, especially the communities, you know, that have not been literate before. That resulted in indigenous empowerment, and it allowed for a kind of naturalized Christianity to take root. Of course, we know with all this indigenization comes, you know, certain problems, which we'll take a look at. Africans also stepped forward to lead the expansion without the disadvantage of foreign compromise, because there was a moratorium on missions from the All Africa Council of Churches in the 1970s. And so, you know, the Africans began to take charge and to take responsibility. Let me say that. They began to take responsibility. And then together with this, there was a theological stimulation of the Christian adoption of the African names of God, particularly for those communities who already had a concept of one God. And so when the gospel was preached to them, it was easier for them to take on Christianity. This is what Sane says about why there's been such an unprecedented growth. And then together with this growth, communities of hope have sprung up in areas of strife and despair, and perhaps that is why the prosperity gospel has become such a threat. Because I think if we think of what our former speaker talked about, people need to be ministered to, and so they have physical needs as well, not just spiritual. And if there is a particular group that is meeting those spiritual needs, that is the group that is going to take over. So we actually need to take note of that. So nevertheless, so even given such a good beginning and the rapid numerical expansion, the African church continues to be hindered by systemic challenges that have taken her voice captive. And I think that somehow we are not speaking out or singing in the way that we ought to. And we know what these challenges are. I won't focus too much on them, Neo-Pentecostalism and its attendant doctrines. I think the book that we're doing is going to handle that. But it's having a very detrimental effect on the growth of the church. I think you will see it in your communities. And you will see how the prosperity, health, and wealth gospel is deceiving people. And people are being led astray, poverty, suffering. And we can see the kind of doctrine. This is from Tanzania. And this, I forget his name, this pastor cannot step on the ground, right? Because he is so anointed, so he has to step on the backs of his followers. Yeah, Carson and I like to use this when we are doing our presentations. And that is eat grass for Jesus. I'm not exactly sure what's happening there. But the congregants were told, eat grass for Jesus. And they blindly follow. I think we don't have time for this, but if you think about our worldview, I like thinking about worldview issues. Authority. If somebody in authority tells you to do something, then it must be right. And it must be good. And it must be something that will be for your benefit. And so the prosperity gospel is something we must take very, very seriously. And of course, because of the poverty and the suffering on the continent, it's a very attractive doctrine, because you plant a seed and you will then prosper and all your troubles will disappear. No more suffering, right? And so it's so, so attractive. The use of electronic media has ensured that this is now in every household. And so we have to ask ourselves, as Baptists, are we in every household? No, we are not. And so these guys are a real threat to us as well. The proliferation of false prophets and of mighty men of God offering healings, miracles, and wealth is undeniable. The funny thing is, as that picture demonstrates, where does the wealth go? It goes to the pastor, and the poor, impoverished members keep giving and giving and giving, and the pastor is getting richer and richer. And I always ask myself, why do the congregants not see that this so-called health and wealth is not coming to them? It's only coming to the pastor. It's a deception and a blindness that I cannot understand. It's very worrying. I don't know if you've heard of Prophet Owuor of Kenya, just to give an example. He now has the largest church in the country. He lives and travels in luxury. He's surrounded by armed bodyguards. I've seen him personally. You cannot come close to him. He has his armed bodyguards around him. And then in a meeting held in Nakuru in December, Nakuru is about, is it an hour away from here or so, he was accompanied by a police escort. Why would a pastor need a police escort? I don't know. And a 40-car motorcade. So he's like the president. His followers would not allow his feet to touch the ground. And they laid down what we call kangas or sarong wraps. So they laid them down on the ground so that he would not, his feet would not touch the ground. He claims to have gone to heaven. He claims to possess power to heal the sick, to make the blind see, and to even raise the dead. But in the recent past, accusations have been leveled against him for staging his healings and miracles because it always comes out. They cannot hide forever. The truth will always come out. And miracles, and for manipulating his congregants to enrich himself. This is just one example. If I were to go to Nigeria, Professor Emiola probably would be able to tell us what is happening in Nigeria. That is even a worse story there. Okay, let's go on to the next thing, syncretism. We know about syncretism, we know about witchcraft, traditional practices such as witchcraft, ancestor worship, polygamy. Did you know these are actually on the rise? Instead of decreasing, they are on the rise. Yet many African countries are Christian. So what is going on there? Sanner defines syncretism as the unresolved, unassimilated, and tension-filled mixing of Christian ideas with local custom and ritual. That means it's not just an African problem. So Westerners have syncretism as well. Yes, so I think it's important that we say that, because whenever we talk about syncretism, it's always an African problem, an Asian problem, but I think it's a universal problem, it's a global problem. So this syncretism has filtered down to the development of new religious movements in the rapid growth of AICs. That's why the church in Africa is growing so fast, because of all these little churches springing up everywhere. But if you really examine those churches, if we were just to take the label, the marks of a healthy church, would those churches be healthy? Whether or not we agree with the marks, but would they be healthy if we look at them biblically? Probably not. As they attempt to make sense of the world, I think that sadly, many of these movements have resulted in a syncretistic blend that can no longer rightly be called Christianity. And that's very worrying. Even more serious, there's a growing group of Christians in Africa that are now rejecting Christianity altogether. I don't know what's happening in the other countries, but in Kenya, the largest tribe in Kenya is the Kikuyu tribe. You know that? No? Okay, I'm telling you. Kikuyus are the largest tribe. They're also the ones who hold political power right now. And this tribe was reached by the gospel. I shouldn't have started that statement because I don't know when, but they were the first to be reached by the gospel, when the missionaries came. Now, there's a very strong movement called Roero Shoke Mukaro, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. Let the river return to its original path. What does that mean? They're saying because Christianity came alongside colonization and European civilization, Christianity took them away from the right path, and that is why we have all the problems that we are experiencing as a nation. So the river must return to the right path. So what does that mean? Let us return to our Kikuyu traditional religion. So traditional initiation and sacrificial ceremonies are now being reinstated alongside Christianity. And the stronger proponents of these are now rejecting Christianity altogether. So if Kikuyus en masse leave Christianity for this is going to be a problem. And so while we celebrate that the church in Africa is really growing, we must recognize these challenges that are plaguing us and that have the power to corrupt the gospel and the way we present the gospel to the rest of the world. Because one of the things that worries me very much is that I believe that Africa is defining Christianity for the next generation. Because we are the most. And so we are the ones who are defining what Christianity is going to look like. And we must make sure that Christianity is biblical Christianity and not the kind of Christianity that we have made it to be. So other challenges, of course, I don't have to talk about corruption, unethical practices, this is always in the news, poverty, disease, suffering, we know about all that, schisms, this is the only picture I could find, but you can see what I mean. Yeah, and you know, our schisms are not based on doctrinal arguments. Our schisms are a result of power struggles. It's politics. And so you split because of politics, not because of the color of the carpet. Kevin, sometimes Baptists do that, I know, the color of the carpet, and doctrinal issues, which is a sad thing. It's just political. And also tribal issues. I'll talk a little bit about tribal issues in a few minutes, because I think we need to understand that our tribal identity is very, very important as an African believer. And we can use it to our good, or it can work against us. And of course, we have the growth of ethnic hostility. I'm sorry, that's such a small picture. I forgot to enlarge it. This happened in Kenya, 2007, after the elections. And what happened is, in the Christian communities, believers who had lived together for such a long time ended up burning each other because they were from different tribes. And these were people that had worshipped together, had fellowshipped together. They locked them in a church and set the church on fire. And so this is a reality. These are some of the challenges that we are facing. And I would say that these challenges stem one of the reasons. I think it's our dichotomized lives. There's a gentleman, a scholar, he's called Magesa. He says, many an African Christian operates with two thought systems at once. Okay? Two thought systems. Both of them are close to each other. Each is only superficially modified by the other. So an African is very compartmentalized. So this is my Christian life, and this is my other life. And that's why a Christian will be corrupt, because there are other things that are pushing. Perhaps it's a communal responsibility to employ a relative. That's nepotism. But for him, he's fulfilling a communal responsibility. And then on the other side, you have Christianity. I wish we had more time to think about this. Buy my book, which is on sale, and you will see what I'm talking about. So this compartmentalization leads to a dichotomous thinking and lifestyle. And when you deal with an African, you have to think about that. That sometimes, we don't do it consciously, but sometimes we are split in the way that we are thinking. So what does Hillman say about this? He says, this is the root of it, the dichotomous thinking, according to Hillman. We're not deliberately trying to destroy them. The colonial processes invariably undermined the systems, values, and views of entire cultural worlds. This we know. Stripped naked and taught in schools and college and churches, to be ashamed of themselves, their primitive and pagan way, the people were coerced morally as well as physically into clothing themselves with the ways of the invading culture. Do we agree? The colonialists taught us that their way was better. I'm not blaming the colonialists for everything. We also have responsibility. However, the colonial incursions, although they brought literacy and antibiotics, made westernization the way of human advancement. That, I think, we can agree. Many people came to believe that progress consists not in being themselves, but in imitating foreign ways. And so as Africans, we kind of try to imitate foreign ways without dealing with our Africanness, if I can put it in that way. So Galgalo also argues that the Christianity that was produced by these missionaries was also one of social and political convenience. And this still happens today. You see people joining a church, becoming a member because it's tribal or because it's politically correct to be part of that church. And that happens. So rather than faith and genuine commitment, the motivating factor for joining a church was and still is historical circumstances, the need for cooperation, affiliation, vested interest, or incidental belonging. So that re-socialization that took place with regards to social, economic, political, religious, ethical, and artistic systems after the onset of the missionary and colonial eras means that African Christians no longer know who they are. And we are imitating the West, but we haven't defined who we are as African Christians. So I believe that the solution for us, in order for us to regain our theological voice, remember that's how we started, the solution is a redefinition of identity. I think that is what we need. If we know who we are, then our voice will be what God intended it to be. Revelation 7:9. It presents a picture of a colorful church. This text we know, we quote it all the time. But what does it mean to think that there will be a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language standing before the throne and before the Lamb? Africans as African Christians, Americans as American Christians, so on and so forth. You get my point. So we redefine our identity by not ignoring who we are as African Christians, and by celebrating the diversity we bring to the church. So what do we need? We need to have a truly biblical worldview while at the same time retaining what is uniquely African. And I think that picture says it all. So there's a Maasai woman singing with her cultural garb, and there is the Bible there. And so there needs to be that. But it must be truly biblical. That is very, very important. So why focus on identity? We've been talking about Baptist identity today, but now I'm talking a little bit broader. Identity is core to our human existence. We operate on the basis of our identities. This we know. And in Africa, our culture, including our religious culture and our tribal identity, may even overshadow our Christian identity. It's very important that you understand that, because we'll all be Christians gathered together, but I'll know, are you a Kikuyu or are you a Luo, or, you know, what tribe are you from? And that seems to form a closer bond than the fact that we are brothers and sisters in Christ. And that is one big problem that we have. So who is an African? What does it mean to be Christian and African? I think that's a question that we really need to wrestle with in this room. Together. What does it mean? Redefining identity is a challenging task at best. And it's a struggle, because people are, I don't want to say they are lazy, but we just want to be who we are. You know, transformation is difficult. And so when we think about this digitally connected era, it's even more difficult to redefine our identity in the right way. Africa is constantly evolving. There are countless voices pulling us in all directions. So how do we figure out who we are? I hope I still have more time. How do we establish our rightful identities in this rapidly changing post-colonial globalized world? Because we have to deal with all that. How do we navigate between the traditional and the modern and postmodern? Because for an African, you're not just dealing with a postmodern world. You're dealing with your traditional cultural realities as well that keep pulling you back because of the aspect of community. You're part of a community. And so how are we going to navigate the traditional and the modern in a way that is going to be balanced? Who are we in relation to God most importantly to God, but also to community? Because as a Christian, you are part of a community of faith. And I think for an African, that is even stronger because of where we have come from and our worldview, which really emphasizes that aspect of community. So what is our true identity? So I propose that an understanding of Jesus' identity in Mark's gospel provides us with a mirror that allows us to reshape our own identity as African Christians. And I'm not going to look at the whole of Mark because that would take too long. I'll only focus on a few selected aspects of Jesus' identity in Mark's gospel. So for those of you that will discuss and say, I didn't talk about this and I didn't talk about that, that's my disclaimer, you know, right up front so that you know. So why Mark? I know Mark is not very popular. People like John, or people like Luke, or people like Matthew, but I've come to love Mark. I think, you know, the way Mark unveils Jesus' identity is just so compelling to me. I never used to like Mark, I'm sorry to say that. Not that, I mean, you know what I mean. I love the whole Bible. I prefer John. And I'm now coming to really appreciate Mark and his style. So as Mark unveils Jesus' identity through a series of conflicts and misunderstandings, we begin to see Jesus as he is. So I'm really looking at the Markan Jesus, to use, you know, New Testament terminology. And as we see Jesus as he is, then we begin to grasp who we should be as his disciples. So Jesus is a mirror for us, and Mark allows us entrance into that. Mark is also probably the most relatable gospel for Africans. I didn't know this until I started writing a commentary on it, and I realized Mark is about identity, but it's also about power, Africans, authority, Africans, suffering, Africans. So when you read Mark and you see these themes coming up, you relate really well to the story of Jesus as told by Mark. And there are also significant parallels with our own African context that enhance its relatability. Mark is very much an oral gospel in the way it's written. When you read Mark, it's as if he's talking. It's not a very literary way of writing. There are many similarities between the worldview and the social-cultural context of the world Mark describes and that of Africa. Of course, the other gospels do it as well, but Mark seems to bring up these similarities more, particularly when you think of the demon exorcisms, Jesus' authority over nature, over the demonic forces. You know, these are things that we really resonate with. And also, it's a story, albeit a real one, but it's a story with features that resemble those of African stories. So when we read Mark, we immediately identify with Mark. And that's why I picked Mark to give us a few lessons. But we must recognize Mark is qualitatively different from African stories because it's theologically motivated. It demands a faith response from us. So I'm not saying Mark is like an African folk story. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there are parallels that we can draw that can help us enter into the story of Mark. So what lessons can we learn from the Gospel of Mark? I think the first thing is integration of culture. Now, this is a very sticky topic because whenever you say, let's integrate our culture, people think of Catholics. And actually, Catholic scholars are the ones that have really been able to do this successfully. But that's not what I'm talking about. Mark, if you think about Mark 2, 18 to 22, it lies at the center of five conflict scenes between chapter 2, verse 1 and chapter 3, verse 6. So when you read this text, you see now that the conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees is now out in the open. Previously, it has been hidden. But as you read this, you see, okay, now we begin to understand your agenda, you Pharisees. We see what you're looking for, and you are trying to put Jesus on the spot. The criticism against Jesus have become more direct as the Pharisees question the validity of Jesus' ministry. And in this text, the bone of contention is that John's disciples and the Pharisees are fasting, but Jesus' disciples are not. So you remember that story? Good. So that's where we are. Now, fasting was a common religious activity practiced in Judaism. It was a feature of the piety of many religious groups, including the Pharisees and the Qumran community. And the thing is, fasting per se was not a requirement of the law, except on the Day of Atonement. The Pharisees, though, had made it their practice to fast twice a week. So a little bit legalistic. That's what the Pharisees were doing. So what is at issue then is fasting that went beyond the normal requirements. So Jesus is not in breach of the law, but he is certainly in breach of tradition. And so this is where they are attacking him. So how does Jesus counter the attack? You would think he would go to the Old Testament, but he doesn't. He turns to the material resources of his Jewish culture. He uses a proverbial saying about a wedding, one that was probably familiar to his attackers. And he illustrates through that proverbial saying that the issue of fasting is not relevant as long as he, the bridegroom, is with his disciples. Let me just remind us that we too, I think, can connect with this proverbial saying, since wedding celebrations are a common feature of African life, right? You can almost hear the women ululating as they greet the bride, as they dance. There's so much celebration. there is definitely no fasting at weddings. So we can connect with this proverbial saying that Jesus has. So anything associated with mourning during such a joyous occasion would be out of place. So there are several reasons why this was also the case in the Jewish culture. First of all, acts of mourning were prohibited during the 7 days of the wedding celebration. You were not allowed to engage in any acts of mourning. Second, Judaism viewed the wedding celebration as a symbol of the new age of salvation. It was a symbol for that. So given that this new age of salvation was present in Jesus, celebration was more appropriate for the disciples than fasting. And that is probably why Jesus did not have his disciples fast when he was with them. Once the bridegroom is taken away, then it would be appropriate for them to fast. So the bridegroom's removal then is, from Hosea, it is an allusion to his own death that was coming. And then in the Old Testament, thirdly, and the intertestamental period, fasting was associated with mourning. So when they heard this proverbial saying, all these connections would have been in their minds, and they would have understood immediately what Jesus was saying through that proverbial saying. So Jesus doesn't only use that proverbial saying, he also uses two parables about wine. Not very Baptist of him, but drinking wine was a common practice in Jewish culture. And so Jesus' opponents would have understood these parables in the way that he intended them. Namely, putting new wine in old wineskins was not wise, as it would only ruin both. So Jesus uses a proverbial saying from his culture, and he also uses a parable, two parables. So Jesus integrated culture to communicate a significant theological truth. Would you agree with me on my exegesis? Because if you do not, then, you know, we just have to stop at this point. Jesus used material resources from his culture to communicate a significant theological point. All right. And we have been told that we are imitating Jesus as we go forward. So the use of a proverbial saying and the two parables assist him in defining the relationship between the law and the newness that he is and that he brings. So instead of giving them a long theological lesson, Jesus said to himself, I think these are what will communicate best because they will understand. It's part of the material resources of the culture. By using those shared cultural resources, Jesus is able to form a bridge that allows him to communicate more clearly that he has not come to reform Judaism. Rather, he represents something new which cannot coexist with the old. So I think the first lesson that we learn is that it's appropriate and even desirable to integrate our culture. I think I'm going to have to go faster. In our philosophies, development, and methods of presentation of theological content, such as in teaching, in preaching, in our written theological material, in our music, the good elements of our culture can be used there. Of course, at the end of the day, the Bible is the final authority, and if there's an aspect of our culture that contradicts biblical truth, no matter how important it is to us or to the community, we must put it aside. And so we need to think about that. I have a couple of examples. I won't go through all of them, but the first two are Catholic scholars that I thought I would bring up here because they've done what we call intercultural hermeneutics, and they use folk stories and African resources to kind of form a bridge into the biblical text. I want to look at Ezekiel Ajibade because of contextualized preaching. He's at the Nigeria Baptist Theological Seminary. I read his book, and I really, really loved the way he did it. He integrates various genres found in the African oral tradition with expository preaching. His expository preaching is sound. I think, what book do you use? Haddon Robinson or, well, Haddon Robinson is a book that I know and that I like. And he is very consistent with that. But what Ezekiel does, then he begins to integrate African song, drama, proverbs, poems, folk tales, and storytelling in contextualized preaching. And he suggests that you can use these elements, these oral elements, because he's really arguing that orality, as we said last year, is still a very crucial aspect of our communities. And so when you integrate oral elements, then you are able to reach your congregants better. He has his book is I think is not here, but it has been published. And one of the things that he does in that book is he gives examples of how this can happen. So, for instance, the pastor is preaching a sermon, and then he begins to sing, and the congregation responds. He sings, and the congregation responds. And so, you see, that is using the material resources from the culture, but ensuring that biblical truth is maintained. And Africans love to sing, so that helps theological truth stick in their minds. And so what I am suggesting is look for those resources in your culture that can help form a bridge, or in our culture, sorry, that can help form a bridge. I think that I have to acknowledge that many Christians in Africa might have a problem with this kind of approach, but it's not new. It's doing what Jesus did, as we saw from the text above. Interrogation of worldview. Jesus teaching with authority. So Mark, that's the second lesson. So the first is we integrate our culture. The second, we interrogate our worldview, which I think is becoming something that we are all saying is very important in our theological studies. Our students are not empty slates, and so we cannot treat them like that. So in chapter 1, verse 21 to 28, Jesus goes to the synagogue, he begins to teach, and then there is someone there who has a demon, and Jesus exorcises the demon, okay? So demon exorcism is part of our worldview. I don't know how many of you have never seen a demon exorcism, or maybe you're Baptist. That is the problem. But in many of our churches, that happens on a regular basis every Sunday, people rolling around on the floor, vomiting, you know, the demons are being cast out, and so on and so forth. So this man that Jesus is exorcising a demon from, he asked Jesus two questions, and then he makes a statement that reveals that he recognizes who Jesus is and the presence of the kingdom of God in his ministry. So this man, or the Spirit through him, recognizes that Jesus will ultimately defeat the satanic forces. Now, we know during that time, exorcism was common. It was in the Jewish worldview. But the way exorcism was done, they used either magical formulas or they called on a higher spirit to expel the lower one. So the way Jesus does it is very, very different. He just speaks a word and it happens. So it is not done in the way that the people have seen it done before. So success in exorcism simply by giving a command was something unheard of. So what I think happens here, Jesus understood the worldview of his audience. In this case, the demon exorcism was a part of life, but he just didn't understand it and go with it. He interrogated it and then acted accordingly. So in this instance, while he did not doubt that the man was demon-possessed and needed deliverance, his approach to the situation was radically different from that of his contemporaries. We can talk about this point a little more if we have time, but the example I'll give is from my book. My book begins with the perspective that our worldview affects and influences how we live life, we agree, and also how we understand the Bible. This is called the four-legged stool model. I gave it an African name. And so I've used the fact that we need to interrogate our worldview even as we read the Bible so that those elements that cause us to understand the text in the wrong way can be put aside, and those elements that help us understand the text in the right way can be incorporated and can help us understand the text. So for instance, if you look at the issue of Hannah and barrenness, just to give an example, because I've gone so fast, I can see some puzzled looks. Hannah, what is barrenness in the African context? How do we understand it? It's a curse or shame, yeah? Honor, shame, value system. Western worldview, barrenness, medical condition, probably. I've never heard my Western friends tell me, I haven't had a baby, somebody has cursed me. I have never heard that. But so in terms of our stepping into the text from our African worldview and using that connection, because it's honor and shame, when we read the story of Hannah, we understand her situation much better as Africans, I think, than a Western reader would. Because we don't automatically jump to medical, we automatically jump to, oh my goodness, this woman must have experienced so much shame as she walked through her community. And so our worldview helps us understand the text. In some cases, it might hinder us. I won't give you the example because there's no time. But in some ways, if you look at ancestor worship, Hebrews 11, you know, the hall of faith, that might hinder us. So we integrate our culture, we interrogate our worldview, and the third lesson is, I hope I will give you at least 5 minutes to, tackle these things, exploitation of our practical orientation. So Jesus, we're talking about the greatest commandment, and we know that, which is the greatest commandment. I won't go through the exegesis, you just have to trust that I handled the exegesis right, and just because of time. So, rather than cite one commandment, Jesus answers with two that are related and that are a summary of the entire law. So, this teacher of the law comes and asks him, which is the greatest commandment? So, he cites the famous Shema from Deuteronomy and the command in Leviticus on interpersonal relationships. So, Jesus talks about love for God and love for others. Okay? That is the greatest commandment. So the love that Jesus talks about is not an abstract feeling, but it's a practical outpouring of oneself, vertically as well as horizontally. So one's faith, that's the implication, manifests itself in concrete acts as a direct outcome of a right relationship with God and others. And here I might get into trouble, because as we preach the gospel, as Africans, we have a practical orientation. It should be our natural inclination to minister to the physical needs as we are sharing the gospel. And I, for me, see no contradiction in that. I would think it wrong to share the gospel and leave somebody in hunger. And so this practical orientation that we have, where we look at the Bible, we are very religious, as has been said before. We look at the Bible, we read it, and we ask, what's the practical? Actually, sometimes we don't even do any exegesis. We just look at the text and apply. So application means that our contextual realities must be addressed. That's what I mean by exploiting our practical orientation. Because it's natural to us already to look at the Bible and ask, what is the concrete thing I need to do with this? So as we are regaining our voice, we exploit this and we teach the rest of the world this. And Kunihop provides us with an example of this in his Christian Ethics. But in exploiting this practical orientation, we have to avoid the fusion of the two horizons of what it meant to the original readers and what it means to us today. So we cannot take the text and say what Paul said to the Ephesians applies directly to us. No, it applied to the Ephesian believers, and then we take that ladder of abstraction and ask ourselves, what does it mean to us today? And then finally, engagement of the community in our theological work. That's very important. I've heard this mentioned a little bit here and there. Mark brings out the issue of inclusivity in chapter 9, verse 38 to 40. There was somebody who was doing some demon exorcism. John stopped him because he said he's not one of us. And Jesus said, whoever is not against us is for us. I'm not talking about an inclusivity that includes all religions. No. That's not what I'm talking about. Those who the criteria is belief in Jesus' name. So those who are believers, and I would think that have a common orientation with us, we need to include in our theological work. Let me explain, because this can get me into trouble. I'm thinking that rather than hiding in our ivory towers, why do we not exploit the fact that the community is very important in Africa? And we can read our Bible together with the community as scholars. We can engage the community in our theological work so that we are not creating programs and curricula that have no impact on the ground because we have not talked to the people on the ground. So I'm talking kind of like an inclusive ideology that says, when I am writing my theological papers, can I ask a lay person, can I talk to a lay person and find out what is going on? Because sometimes we are talking up here and we forget that ordinary readers are not just fields of application, that we do our work and then we give them the product. They should be part of the process of developing that product. And I've gone very fast on that. So Okpong has done that. He calls it community reading. Teresa Okure, she's a feminist. I'm not endorsing her views. I'm just saying that in her method of involving women as she reads the text, she begins to understand the issues of women, especially for women who are in the same conditions as those in the biblical text. And then she's able to understand the perspective of the biblical writer better. And Kevin is looking at me, so now I am winding up. So I've said quite a lot of things in terms of how we are to regain our voice. I talked about integrating our culture. I talked about interrogating our worldviews. I talked about exploiting our practical orientation. And I also talked about engaging the community in our theological work. And especially that last one, when we have practicums, when our students go out and they're doing their practicums, let them not just engage with the pastor, let them engage with the people that come to church. And that is going to have an impact on how we do theology. So some of these approaches overlap. So for instance, with me, I begin with an interrogation of worldview, but I also make use of cultural resources. Okpong talks about community readings, but he also emphasizes practical application. And I want to read this statement because it's very important. The goal of interpretation is the actualization of the theological meaning of the text in today's context, I haven't put it there, so as to forge integration between faith and life and engender commitment to personal and societal transformation. So unless we move from text to application, transformation will never take place. That is Okpong who is talking about that. So we are talking about a two-way dialogue in all these approaches that I have really just thrown at you, and I hope that you've picked up something from that. We need a two-way dialogue between the world of the biblical text and the world of traditional and contemporary African realities. That is why I'm emphasizing those things that Africa is rich in: culture, worldview, practical orientation, and community. Let's have that dialogue with the Bible. I think that kind of dialogue is what will allow African Christians to forge an identity that mirrors that of Jesus Christ himself. And I think that we will have a positive output if we do that, or things along those lines. We'll develop contextualized theological education because we'd have understood our culture and how our students are embedded in their tribal identities, and so we'll be able to provide education that helps. We'll promote contextualized models of biblical preaching that will now be effective. We're looking for transformation, but not just looking for good-sounding sermons. We will develop relevant ecclesiology. What is the African church supposed to look like? And we'll provide a global impact through scholarship and missions as we begin to think about new ways of doing things.